about to have a conversation with Dr. Manisha Sinha, who is a professor at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. She's also chair of the Graduate Department in African American Studies, and has written her latest book is called The Slave's Cause, A History of Abolition, which I think is probably, for all the things I read over the course of my life on abolition and on the history of this country, the most thorough history of abolition I've ever seen. I've been dying for this conversation to take place. So, Dr. Manisha Sinha, welcome to the Mark Steiner Show. Good to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
So let's take a step. This book is, is it 600 pages? Do I have that right?
Well, only 500 pages or so of text.
Right, right.
Many more footnotes.
but what I said about this book in an overview, just before we get into some specifics, is that there's an immediacy to this book, an intimacy to this book, because the research you've done is kind of delved into the lives of people who were in the abolition movement from the 1700s on, people who and their interactions personally and politically that kind of defined the movement, black and white. So I mean, that's just the amount of research this must have taken.
Yes, it took me 10 years actually of
I can believe that.
Research and writing. Yeah, it was a long haul.
So I mean, and unearthed writings and people that we've never heard of before. Most of us have never been acquainted with in this movement.
Absolutely. I think there's just so many ordinary men and women, black and white, free and enslaved, who were part of the movement that are really what I call America's unsung heroes. You know, we know of a few prominent figures, especially now they are getting acknowledgement after a very long time, people like Harriet Tubman. But there were so many ordinary folk who sort of galvanized the movement and contributed to it. And I wanted to make sure that I tell their story too.
But I think the importance of that, and just in the approach to this, is the struggles that people actually went through in this movement for over 200 years in the battle to end slavery, to the abolition, and what it meant to be in that movement, what it meant to be literally a group of persecuted people trying to end the persecution of slavery. I mean, just the power
yes,
of that.
Yes, absolutely. You know, I think that people forget that abolitionists were not popular in their time, and a lot of them, as you pointed out, were persecuted. You know, some lost jobs, some were barred from colleges, libraries, institutions. You know, people did not like the fact that abolitionists were raising very insistently the issue of slavery because they felt it threatened the Union. They felt slavery was essential to the nation's economic life, which, of course, they were right about. It lay at the heart of American economic development. It had certain protections in the Constitution that no one wanted to challenge. And, of course, a lot of free black people and enslaved people joined the movement. And most people in the United States at that time did not react very favorably to them. There were a lot of sort of diehard racists, and there were also people who simply could not imagine black people as sort of equal citizens in this country, which is what the abolition movement really was trying to attain, not just the abolition of slavery, but also black citizenship and racial equality.
I just want to bring up a few names. One of the first names that really struck me in this book was Benjamin Lay.
Mm-hmm.
Nope, nobody knows who this man was in history.
Yeah.
This Quaker, this.
Diminutive. Lay is one of my favorite people. You know, he's you know, just a working class abolitionist. He's a sailor. He apologizes in his book. He says, "I'm illiterate, but I have to write about this horrible wrong." And he's a lot like a modern day activist, actually, because you know, he would do things like kidnap somebody's child or a slaveholder's child to acquaint him with the grief of African parents whose children had been kidnapped from them or sold away from them. He would lie, you know, he would stand barefoot in the snow to show people that, you know, slaves develop frostbitten toes and feet if you do not clad them properly. You know, he refused to drink tea or have sugar in his tea because it was made by slave labor. And he basically said that if you consume things made by slave labor, you are actually consuming these people's blood, their body, their lives, literally. So he's just an amazing sort of modern day activist, virtually, in his radicalism and in his tactics. So he definitely is one of those people who needs to be remembered.
And you describe him very diminutive, almost like a dwarf.
Yeah, he was hunchback. He was dwarfed, like kind of an outcast. And I think he empathized probably with people who were seen as outcast in society, racially or otherwise. You know, at one point he even threw blood at the Bibles of Quakers to say that this represents the blood of slaves. So, you know, here he is, this person who is, you know, sort of does not move around in polite society. In fact, he exiles himself. He lives in a cave virtually after the death of his wife, and he's just devotes his life to kind of a radical activism to draw attention to the plight of slaves. He's a very interesting figure.
So I want to get some overarching themes here, which I think are really important. One is the way we look at abolition in this country, and I think that it is grabbing America bit by bit with this new TV series, Underground, which I've watched, and it makes me think we're in like a social wave at the moment to really kind of wrestle with this and how it relates to who we are today. One of the things you put in here, which I think is really critically important, is the power of the black voice in this movement from its very beginnings. We always look at abolitionists as white movement to free black people. But you see it in a very different way.
Yes. You know, abolition was an interracial, radical social movement. And, you know, even white abolitionists like Benjamin Lay would always point to instances of slave resistance as having inspired them. This notion that somehow abolitionists consisted of white middle class people trying to help black people is just inaccurate, because right from the start, as you point out, there are black writers, there are black petitioners, there are black people suing for their freedom. You know, they were very much at the heart of the movement. You know, I write in my book that slave resistance, rather than sort of white bourgeois liberalism, defined the abolition movement. We need to look at African Americans who were at the center of the movement and who in many cases actually pioneered in developing the tactics and ideas behind abolition.
And you said one thing in what you just said that you write about in this book, which I think is important, which is the power that the slave revolts, be they on ships or on the plantation, the power of people fighting back, that really fueled the movement and fueled the Northern abolitionists to fight even harder.
Yes, I think slave rebellions really radicalized the movement. You know, beginning with the Haitian Revolution, to Nat Turner's rebellion, to the later shipboard revolts of the Amistad and the Creole slave rebellions. They really radicalized abolitionist discourse and practice. I mean, many abolitionists started demanding sort of immediate abolition, trying to follow Haiti. Actually, it is the only country, the only instance of immediate abolition before the Civil War. You had gradual emancipation in the North in most of the states, and you also had a kind of a gradual compensated program for emancipation in the British West Indies. So you can see how slave rebellions really radicalized abolitionists. Many even sort of mainstream anti-slavery politicians start defending slave rebels. They see them in the tradition, in the revolutionary tradition. And, you know, William Lloyd Garrison always says, you know, how can you praise George Washington and in the same breath condemn Nat Turner? Because after all, he was also fighting for the liberty of his people.
And in that, I think that I mean, the political dialogue inside the abolition movement is another very important area you covered in depth. in some real detail. And I think that this is really important, I think, because I think that, A, we don't think of the slave rebellions as being as intense and as societally encompassing mm-hmm. as they were, and how they changed the nature of the dialogue inside that movement, and even so, you split the movement.
Yes, I think for so long, abolitionists have been misrepresented as either hypocrites, you know, white Northerners who knew nothing about slavery, or as those who took on the cause of abolition for flippant reasons, that they were not true radicals. But if you read them, if you read their literature, if you read their newspapers, their pamphlets, even slave narratives written by, you know, fugitive slave abolitionists, some who became very famous, you know, you can really get a sense of the radicalness and the depth of their commitment to ideas at that time that were regarded as, you know, really fanatic and extreme. For instance, the idea of black equality. And what's interesting is that the abolition movement, as you pointed out, you know, sort of provides a space for people to debate their radical ideas. So there are differences amongst abolitionists over a whole host of issues. You know, some feel that you should work within the political system. You know, debates that we still have today within the political system to effect change and to actually lead to the destruction of slavery by passing laws, etc. Others felt that the state was just dominated by slaveholders and that there was no use in working politically. Those especially who followed Garrison tended to be pretty radical in their ideas. Abolitionists also debated women's rights. You know, some abolitionists opposed women's rights, not because they were necessarily against it, but they felt that they should not saddle their movement with another unpopular cause, which was to fight for women's right to vote. So there were all these issues that sometimes divided the movement over tactics or even issues of principle of how far they should criticize the state, how much they should criticize the church for its complicity with upholding slavery. What I argue in the book is that it really leads to a space where you have a cross-fertilization of some really interesting radical ideas. And it also challenges the fact that, you know, we think of abolitionists as just working against the destruction of slavery, but in fact they were pretty wide-ranging and eclectic in their radicalism. You know, many of them were championing the rights of women and labor and immigrants and Native Americans. You know, they were quite wide-ranging in their radicalism.
And I think that one of the things that struck me about what you're describing now and in this book, including when you bring in the transcendentalists and the movement around free love and the anti-capitalist movement around the mm-hmm. burgeoning socialist movement and all that explosiveness inside and affecting and going back and forth with the abolitionist movement in this country, is that you, if you reflect on and whether or not like Garrison and Douglas, which we'll talk about in a little bit, that if you think about where we are in the 21st century and the battles we're having in America now over which course to take to secure and defend the progressive changes in America to make them even more intense and deeper in this country, it's very much like then. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? And when you look at that, you realize these forces might have been battling each other, but that synergy and energy ended slavery. Like the synergy and energy now are going to end in a place we don't even realize at this moment.
That could very well be the case. I mean, you look at all these movements like Occupy Wall Street or Black Lives Matter, and sometimes they remind me a little bit of the abolitionists because they are fighting against a whole host of, you know, economic injustice, racial inequalities, you know, the very ideas that actually motivated the abolitionists. And it would be interesting to see where we go from here and whether these movements, these radical social movements, can actually affect political change. What was interesting about the abolitionists is that even though they are such radicals, they are also sometimes working with politicians, even Garrison, who actually thinks that the American state or the American government is too pro-slavery. He burns a copy of the U.S. Constitution and a copy of the federal fugitive slave law. because he thinks they're all pro-slavery. Even he works with politicians, you know, and tries to influence political change. And you can see how that ground fertilized by abolitionists actually leads to the rise of new parties that are devoted to at least restricting the spread of slavery, if not ending slavery. So I see a kind of a symbiotic relationship between many of these more mainstream political parties and the abolitionist movement, the radical movement. And it's always interesting to see how they're able to push for political change within the system, too.
And I think that's why the history is why this history is so important, because how we cannot understand where we are now unless we understand the intensity and the interplay inside that history that you're laying out here. I think and there's a couple of examples. I mean, one of the things I think really is important is with your whole chapter on the women question, the woman question, and when you talk about. When you write that African-American women played a crucial role in the rise of Milton Black abolitionism, and then name some of these women like Maria Stewart and Sarah Mapps Douglas, Sarah Louise Fortin, Jerina Lane, who we do not know in today's world. But we always think of this thing as white women doing this, right?
Yes, and that's mainly because a lot of women's history sort of privileges many of these white women suffragists who are important in their own right.
No question.
But they kind of privilege them as saying that they began the fight for women's rights, people like Elizabeth Cady Stanton or Susan B. Anthony. But you can go right back to the abolition movement and see many of these abolitionist feminists, many of them were African Americans. Many of them fought for women's rights and fought for racial equality, and they were what we call intersectional, who looked at both racial and gender oppression. Scholars call that term intersectional, and there were many black women who were doing this within the abolitionist movement, and then other white women too who followed them, and like the Grimke sisters or like Abby Kelly Foster or Lucy Stone. And we forget about these women because we tend not to look at the origins of the women's rights movement within the abolition movement. And I think one has to do that. One has to see how abolition actually spawns all these other radicalisms and other movements. And when the women's movement, at least the segment that is led by Stanton and Anthony, sort of, develops a sort of a break with the abolition movement during the Civil War and Reconstruction, they gain something. They form an independent women's movement, but as I write in the book, they also lose a lot, and that is the abolitionist commitment to racial equality. So I really wanted to highlight this kind of prehistory to the suffrage movement in the abolition movement amongst black and white women who fought for women's rights and against slavery and for racial equality a long time before the suffragists came onto the scene.
And, we're watching Bernie Sanders talk about democratic socialism. And one of the other stories left out of the abolition movement is the interplay with socialist ideas, with the interplay of communitarian ideas that did grab a hold of a lot of people, including Douglas and Garrison and others. They were this was part of the political dynamic.
Yes, I mean, I think abolitionist sort of early critiques of capitalism has been vastly underestimated. Most historians write that the abolition movement and the labor movement were at loggerheads and that somehow abolitionists were not concerned about the plight of wage workers, of white workers, that they concentrated their efforts only on enslaved people. And again, I found that to be simply not correct. I found many abolitionists writing against the rise of the factory system and the ways in which workers were being oppressed in the North. And they tried to make a connection, actually, between workers and enslaved people and starving peasants in Ireland, between oppressed people all over the world. They had a kind of a universalism in a way when they talked about oppressed people in different nations. And many of them experimented with these early, you know, utopian socialist societies. And many of these early utopian socialists were actually sympathetic to abolition. And you find, you know, utopian societies like the one in Northampton, Massachusetts, that included whites and blacks, like the black abolitionist David Ruggles and Sojourner Truth, who spent a lot of time at the Northampton utopian community, and, you know, where she gets her sort of broad-ranging radicalism also from. You know, she is fighting against slavery for women's rights, and she is just very wide-ranging also in the causes that she espouses. So, yeah, I was fascinated at the ways in which the sort of early socialist movements and early communitarian movements, these attempts to form cooperative and communal societies that would reject the oppressions of mainstream society. I was fascinated by the ways in which abolitionists were interested in it and took part in it.
But one of the things I think that is important to kind of talk about, which I think also relates to who we are now, as all this whole book does to me. So, you know, you write about this effort that abolitionists had to kind of reach out to the white working class movements, to the Irish mm-hmm. themselves, who were the heart of it in the northeast of this country. But there were contradictions inside there. You might have had people you write about, like
right.
O'Connell, but you also mm-hmm. you talk about people. What's this guy, Walsh? Why am I blocking mm-hmm. his first name?
Right.
Michael Walsh.
Michael Walsh, yeah.
Right, who was a leader of the working class movement in New York, an Irishman who would not unite with abolitionists. So there were all these contradictions around race inside that movement that exploded that possible unity, didn't allow it to really build.
Yeah. I mean, just make some other radical abolitionists make an effort to reach out to labor. And there are some labor leaders like George Henry Evans, et cetera, who are sympathetic to abolition. But unfortunately, the abolitionists are not able to woo the immigrant working class, at least not the Irish, as much as they wanted to. And what's interesting is, in terms of alliances with the working class or with Irish immigrants, abolitionists are far more successful in Britain and Ireland than they are back home in America. Part of it is, you know, historians argue that the Irish, like other immigrants, try to accrue the wages of whiteness, where they try to demonstrate their loyalty to their adopted country by, you know, by sort of seeing abolitionists as sort of unpatriotic. And what was interesting is that the Irish tend to get very involved with the Democratic Party, which at that time was the party was leaning heavily towards the South, was seen as more protective of slaveholders' interests and much more anti-abolitionist. So you can see the Irish, you know, sort of being incorporated into the Democratic Party, sometimes being part of these urban mobs against black people with whom they competed for jobs and housing space. And also sometimes, you know, they were, you know, the part of anti-abolition mobs. That attacked abolitionist meetings. So what Garrison tries to do is he tries to have the great Irish nationalist Daniel O'Connell, who's also abolitionist, try and reach out to Irish immigrants to tell them to join up with the abolitionists. And unfortunately, those efforts are unsuccessful. And in the end, O'Connell repudiates some of these pro-slavery, you know, Irish groups that are supporting his efforts to gain the repeal of the union between Ireland and Britain. You know, he tells them famously, it was not in Ireland you learned this cruelty. So Garrison is unsuccessful a little bit in, Garrison and the abolitionists as a whole are not that successful. But by the 1850s, increasingly, you can see a lot of working class you know, parties and conventions and unions are seeing slavery also as a threat to their livelihood and to the existence of, you know, a fair society for labor. And you can see more instances of convergence in the 1850s where you have sometimes working class radicals taking part in fugitive slave rescues. You have labor conventions passing, resolutions supporting the abolitionists or supporting the anti-slavery Republican Party. You can see that sort of move more towards anti-slavery in the 1850s than you do in the earlier period.
So we're going to take a very brief break. We're here talking to Dr. Manisha Sinha. Her latest book is The Slave's Cause, A History of Abolition. We'll be right back with more of this. Try to get as much as we can in the next half an hour. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner here with Dr. Manisha Sinha, who is the head of the African American Graduate Studies Program at the University of Massachusetts, and Amherst, I should add, and author of a number of books like The Counter-Revolution of Slavery, Politics and Ideology in Antebellum South Carolina, and this latest work, which is just a mind-blowing work in terms of its depth, The Slave's Cause, A History of Abolition. And I want to pick up here something that, just to give, again, back to an overview, because you really do see in many ways this the abolition movement, which I think is an important concept to this part to talk about now. This was not just a 19th century movement or an 18th. This is a movement that came from the 1700s on through, and you see it in two very different waves. But to talk a bit about your theory there.
Yeah, mostly when people talk about the abolition movement, they tend to look at the years just before the Civil War.
Right.
And the start of the radical abolition movement. And many times they spoke mainly of the white abolitionists, ignoring the sort of black militants who had preceded them in the 1820s. But I found, you know, studying this book, I found myself going right back to the American Revolution and back to the 18th century because, you know, the first wave of abolition really took place during the era of the American Revolution. And many of those early Quaker abolitionists that we talked about and early black writers and thinkers were part of that first wave of abolition. And I wanted to make sure that in order to tell the full story of abolition, I looked at both the first wave during the 18th century and early 19th century and the second wave preceding the Civil War. And so I found myself going back and telling the sort of history of abolition in the long durée. And this is how one can see how abolition really influenced and contested the development of American democracy itself, because it really comes of age in the era of the American Revolution when you have emancipation in the North. People forget that there was slavery in the northern states too, and that they had to get rid of slavery by passing laws, etc. So, I thought that to tell the full story of abolition, one could also then tell the story of their contributions to the growth of freedom and of democracy in this country.
And I think that's really very critical to understand. And there's another piece in here. I'd be remiss if I didn't bring up, just because where we are here in Baltimore. And also it's one of my obsessions that you write extensively about in this book. And I actually happen to live in the midst of this area, which is the Christiana Rebellion. I live right up where Gorsuch's farm would have been.
Uh-huh.
And so this is a huge piece of our history. I always call it the other September the 11th. because of when the trial began. And so
right.
Talk a bit about that, because this also goes to the heart of the power of the resistance of freed people who fought back to not be re-enslaved and were not afraid to fight back. So I think this is something we also don't know. But talk a bit about this particular piece and William Parker and Edwin Gorsuch and who they were and what happened here, because I think it's emblematic of a lot of things we don't understand about our history.
Yeah, that's a great question, because it really showcases the radicalism of abolition and the ways in which enslaved people and formerly enslaved people contributed to the movement. So, you know, right from the start, you find free black people and people who stole themselves, right? Freedom seekers, self-emancipated slaves, going up north and other free places and settling those areas, sometimes with the assistance of abolitionists. And this area in southern Pennsylvania, bordering Maryland, was really one of those active areas of the abolitionist underground, because so many enslaved people from Maryland had fled to Pennsylvania, to this area, and many of them had neighbors who were Quakers and anti-slavery in sympathy, and sometimes employed people who came up here. So you really had a community here of, former slaves, free blacks, anti-slavery Quakers, later on abolitionists, black and white, who are operating in terms of helping fugitive slaves come through this area and even settle there. On the other hand, you had Maryland slaveholders who are always trying to reclaim their property from, quote, their human property from this area, and who sometimes, send in slave catchers, sometimes with the help of law enforcement officials, and sometimes even with the help of kidnappers. There was a gang there called the Gap Gang that actually kidnapped even, suspected fugitive slaves or free blacks back in slavery. So the Solomon Northrop story is not unusual. It happened quite a bit. So what happens, of course, in Christiana, though, is that it takes place after the enactment of the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850, which is a very draconian law. It tries to criminalize assisting fugitives. It tries to really make every free black person virtually into a suspected fugitive and denies them rights to trial by jury, et cetera, that, northern states had attempted to give free black people and enslaved people. So immediately after the enactment of this law, you had Edward Kossuth, who was a Maryland slaveholder, trying to recover his enslaved people, men who had escaped to this area, were working in farms there. And William Parker, who was an escaped slave himself, a free black man who had assisted many other fugitives before and had confronted, slave catchers before, they come to his home because they're told that that's where they will find their slaves. And what's interesting is that it results in a pitched battle between Kossuth, a federal marshal, and these free black people who are, take up arms, and the women too. What's interesting is that even Parker's wife and others in the family are willing to resist these men. And then, of course, one of them is shot dead. And this becomes the famous Christiana Rebellion in Pennsylvania. Eventually the case, lands up in the court. He actually escapes all the way to Canada. And he's assisted on the way, interestingly enough, by Frederick Douglass, who keeps his pistol as a memento. But the trials, when they come up, they are mainly of whites who assisted and who necessarily did not take part in actually kind of opposing these men, the slaveholders and their allies. So most of the black people who are involved, for some reason, their trials don't go through. It's really the whites who are tried for treason against the state. One of the people representing them is Thaddeus Stevens, the radical anti-slavery politician who becomes a prominent radical Republican. Your audience might remember him from the movie Lincoln. But Thaddeus Stevens is one of the lawyers who defends them. Again, showing how anti-slavery lawyers and politicians were part of this sort of abolitionist resistance against the implementation of the federal fugitive slave law. But the people who really were on the ground taking up arms and refusing to be re-enslaved were, of course, black people themselves, and mainly, leaders like William Parker, who, was very active in defending fugitives in that area. So yeah. It's a fascinating story, it is one of the prominent fugitive slave rebellions of the 1850s.
I mean, Frederick Douglass, I remember he wrote about that, saying that that he thought the Christiana as you think said more than anything else, destroy the future of slave law. I mean, and as a matter of fact, it turns out that William Parker escaped from the same plantation that Frederick Douglass lived on.
That's interesting. I did not know that fact.
Yeah,
but I know that the Eastern Shore of Maryland produced a lot of radicals.
Yes,
Tubman, Douglas, Parker. There's so many of them.
Lots of
Must
them.
Must be something in the air.
And he was assassinated when he came back for the 40th anniversary to Christiana by people who opposed didn't like what happened then. 40 years later, they assassinated him on the road as he was leaving. So
oh my goodness.
He's a fascinating story. But anyway, back to your book. I'm sorry.
That is a great story.
That's a great story. Yes. But I want you to, for a minute, since we're talking about the Fugitive Slave Act, the period of the Missouri Compromise, give us a sense from your book of what the political dynamics were at that moment in the battle around the Missouri Compromise, a battle around the Fugitive Slave Act, and what that political war was like and the role abolitionists played in that.
Yeah, well, you know, what happens is that after the Mexican War of 1846, the United States acquires a broad swath of territory in the Southwest, and the political question becomes whether these territories would come into the Union as slave or as free states. And this is when you have the rise of political anti-slavery feeling in the North. And in a way, as I said earlier, the abolitionists had already laid the ground for it. You know, abolitionists had been petitioning Congress, not just for the abolition of slavery and black rights. They had been petitioning Congress to recognize Haiti. They were against the annexation of Texas, because that would be introducing more slave territory into the Union, against the annexation of Florida, against the domestic slave trade, which is what new slave states meant. You know, it led to the revival of the domestic slave trade from the old slave states to the new slave states out into the Southwest. So abolitionists had been opposing this kind of expansion of the Cotton Kingdom, the expansion of slavery. And increasingly, I think their agitation had an effect in the aftermath of the Mexican War, when many Northerners started fearing that, in fact, their republic would become a slaveholding republic. In fact, it was a slaveholding republic, but the idea that, you know, really free states would be in the minority and it would really become a nation, a republic dominated by slavery. And you have the rise of free soil parties, eventually in the 1850s, the Republican Party. Now, this was a crisis for the Union, because when Northerners start demanding that any state that enters the Union, you know, enters it as a free state, Southerners were demanding the opposite. They wanted slave states to enter the Union. And the last time this question had come up was over the entrance of Missouri into the Union. And the Missouri Compromise was that they allowed Missouri to enter the Union as a slave state in 1820. And they said that basically the southern border of Missouri, the line 36-30 inches, the latitude, would be a marker between slave and free states. Now, with the Compromise of 1850, you know, they argue that instead of implementing the Missouri line, politicians argue for what they call popular sovereignty. Let whites decide whether they want slavery or not. Let white settlers decide whether they want slavery or not. And abolitionists were completely against it. And free soilers, anti-slavery politicians, also felt that the federal government should actually prohibit, should ban the expansion of slavery into these areas. And already Southerners are evoking states' rights to say, no, let states enter as, you know, slave states. So this is a big political question, and it is resolved by another compromise, the Compromise of 1850, which says all the territories acquired from Mexico should, you know, have what they call popular sovereignty. Let white settlers decide whether they want slavery or not. And with this compromise, they abolished the slave trade, just the slave trade in Washington, D.C., not slavery, but just the slave trade, which was one of the big abolitionist demands to actually abolish the domestic slave trade. And they passed the federal fugitive slave law as, you know, for the South, for Southern slaveholders to enforce those laws more strictly. And the compromise is really not a compromise. It's what one historian has called an armistice, because, you know, the South gets something, the North gets something, and their representatives vote for whatever they want to vote for, and they abstain on the others, or they vote against the parts of the compromise that they don't like. But somehow or the other, this compromise is cobbled together and all these bills are passed. And eventually even that fails, because when Kansas is organized as a state, you have a full state of war between free state settlers and slave state settlers trying to determine whether this state should come in as a free or a slave state, even though free staters had an overwhelming majority in terms of population. So this is what is happening politically. But these controversies over the expansion of slavery, over the slave trade, over fugitive slaves, they would not have happened if abolitionist agitation hadn't taken place over such a long time period, and made Northerners wary of some of these issues. So somebody like Abraham Lincoln, who is a Whig and eventually joins the Republican Party, finally comes to realize the enormity of slavery, starts talking about the moral problem of slavery in the country during this period. So I really do see the abolitionists as being at the vanguard, at the forefront of even these political movements against slavery.
So, I mean, in some ways, I think the important point here to me is that it's often too simplistic just to simply say Lincoln didn't oppose slavery. It's more important, I think, in some ways to do, which I think you're doing in this book, which is to talk about the power of movements to force a nation to deal with something they do not want to deal with. In this case, the biggest thing in our nation is slavery, and now we're dealing with the repercussions of slavery, the depth of racism in America. But I think that it's really important to understand the role of a movement here and what it did. Mm-hmm. Black and white men and women together, not compromising and pushing.
Yes. Absolutely. I think that people forget that, you know, that you know, one should recognize that, of course, Lincoln opposed slavery, but he came late to anti-slavery, and his position was as far as he could go as a politician. I mean, he always said that, you know, I'm against the expansion of slavery, which was the party of the which was a platform of the Republican Party, but he did not, you know, he said, well, I'm not an abolitionist, because he sort of revered the Union and Constitution at the same time. But during the Civil War, when he had the opportunity, in fact, to act on abolition, he was able to do so because, in a way, the abolitionists had already set the standard. And eventually, by his death, he is even talking about black rights. He's talking about black citizenship for former Union soldiers and for educated black men. I don't think he would have adopted any of these positions, non-extension, abolition, black citizenship, without the fact that there was constant pressure on anti-slavery politicians like him to act on abolition, to act on black rights. I think the fact that Lincoln moves from colonization, which was this program to send free black people back to Africa, to black rights, shows that he actually evolved in his anti-slavery. And in order to evolve, I think, you needed the movement people. You needed the radical abolitionists who were always pushing at the boundaries of American democracy.
So let's talk for a moment. I think it's important here, even though these are two very well-known names in the world of abolition, but they're critical names, really. William Lloyd Garrison and Frederick Douglass.
Mm-hmm.
People often look at the split that happened between Garrison and Douglass as merely about race and racism.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the complexity gets lost that you are unearthing for us. Mm-hmm. In their relationship politically, their relationship personally, their own human relationships, and what they believed in terms of how to handle abolition. In many ways, Garrison may have been the more radical of the two.
Mm-hmm.
So talk a bit about that, and also give a little sense of who Garrison was as well.
Yeah, I mean, I found the sort of representation of the Douglas-Garrison split to be very troubling in the historiography, in the way historians and had written about that split as merely a racial one. You know, that it was because Garrison was being racist, that Douglas wanted to be independent of him. And to a certain extent, you know, Garrison mentored Douglas into the abolition movement. So there was a little bit of that. But this notion that it was all had to do with race, I found was just too simplistic and really completely misrepresented some of the very important issues that Douglas and Garrison debated. You know, the reason why the split, rather, between Garrison and Douglas takes place, not because Douglas simply sets up his independent newspaper. I mean, Garrison warns him that it's a tough thing to do to set up an independent abolitionist paper, but there are just not that many subscribers to abolitionist views in the United States. At the same time, he eventually comes around to Douglas being his own independent editor and establishing his paper in New York. I think the split comes really in the early 1850s when Douglas moves from the Garrisonian position, which is to see the Union and the Constitution as pro-slavery, to the political abolitionist position, which was to see the Constitution actually as an anti-slavery document, anti-slavery in spirit, and that could be used against slaveholders. And there were possibilities rising there. You had the Free Soil Party, and in the horizon was the rise of the Republican Party. And Garrison was Douglas was very supportive of the abolitionist Liberty Party, too. Remnants of that still existed. Douglas was seeing the possibilities, the political possibilities that Garrison did not. Garrison was a quintessential radical agitator, and he felt that his role was to push the pendulum of politics from outside. While Douglas was increasingly seeing the potential of creating an anti-slavery party that would effect the abolition of slavery legally in the country. And, you know, so I went through some of the the personalities that they both don't show up in a very good light, and they both become very personal against each other. I detail that story, but I really wanted to emphasize the ideological split, that this was a programmatic split between the two. It is far more serious than just a matter of race. And to portray it as just a matter of race actually belittles the very serious differences of opinion and the very sound points that they both got to the table. And in the end, you know, as I say in the book, both Douglas and Garrison are right.
You two
because
have,
Douglas right. was right. You know, you had abolition through political means, exactly as he predicted it, through a political anti-slavery party. And Garrison is right, because Garrison had argued that unless you really change the hearts and minds of white Americans, which he thought was the real problem, that any victory against slavery and racism would not be permanent. It would be fleeting. And that you could not, in the end, legislate racial equality. You really had to make sure that people in their hearts accepted the end of slavery, which clearly, you know, former slaveholders did not do. So you could say in the end that, you know, both their tactics were needed. Also interesting for me to read was to read Douglas's eulogy of Garrison when
yes.
Garrison dies well after the Civil War. You know, Douglas points out he's not shy about the differences of opinion they had. He actually mentions that even in his eulogy. But he also recognizes Garrison's place in, you know, really bringing together the second wave of interracial immediatism, of, you know, immediate uncompensated abolition that was finally effected. So yes, I wanted to portray that split in a far more complex fashion than historians had. And I think part of it is because they had this sort of stereotypical image of, you know, sort of racially paternalistic and hypocritical abolitionists, which, oddly enough, you know, slaveholders were the first to talk about abolitionists in that way. And that history has been pretty entrenched in American historiography, in American historical scholarship.
So in the last couple of minutes we have left, I would like you to just describe, pick any one person you'd like. I mean, you discovered so many new people for us and for yourself in this research,
yeah.
Right? So
right.
Pick somebody that really spoke to you, then maybe one of the women.
Yeah, well, among the women, the one who I think has completely been neglected, and I have a student of mine writing a biography of her, and there have been some other scholars who paid attention to her, but is this black woman, feminist, abolitionist, Frances Ellen Watkins Harper. I find her so interesting because, you know, she writes abolitionist literature. She is very popular at the lecture circuit. She's involved in the Underground Railroad, and she's a feminist who becomes involved in the suffrage movement after the Civil War. So she's one of these forgotten figures in history of abolition and American history. And I found her very interesting because at one point she would write these sentimental poems. On the other hand, she would write these polemical essays in black newspapers where she would sort of criticize Lincoln for his colonization plans and goad him on to emancipation and black rights. I mean, she just adopted these various voices, and she's one of those people that I think deserves a lot more attention than she gets. I recently wrote another piece on her. For the online journal Commonplace, which comes out of the American Antiquarian Society. And a student of mine who is writing on her actually has discovered her first book of poems, which was thought lost to history. So she's interesting, and she's so, you know, she comes from an abolitionist family. She's an orphan who's looked after by her abolitionist uncle, William Watkins, who was a prominent black abolitionist right there in Baltimore. And he was actually a mentor to Garrison. When Garrison comes to Baltimore to work with Benjamin Lundy, he actually serves an apprenticeship not just with Lundy, but also with black abolitionists in Baltimore, people like William Watkins, her uncle. So I wish people would know more about her and some of these, you know, staunch black abolitionist families that actually were abolitionist activists for generations. Yeah, she's one of those. If I had to choose a woman, she'd be the person that I want people to know more about.
Dr. Manisha Sinha, thank you so much for this conversation today. And I just want to let our listeners know The Slave's Cause, A History of Abolition, I think is, for me, one of the most important books about a history that's been written in a long time. And I encourage you all to spend some time with it. And Dr. Manisha Sinha, thank you.
Thank you, Mark.
We're going to take a short break, but stay with us. When we come back, we hear another segment from the Steiner Show archives. And on our way to break, I want to remind you, the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. More information at www.mecu.com or steinershow.org is MeQ, Baltimore Credit Union's banner.